Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, March 30, and I'm your reader, Kathleen, still reading to you from sunny Arizona. What a privilege. Our first article from the front page, Advocates Seek a Ban on Landlord. We can't babysit our tenants, lawyer for Cedar Rapids property owner says. This story is submitted by Marissa Payne. Community advocates are publicly calling on the city to permanently revoke Charles A. Davison's permit to lease property in Cedar Rapids, saying he is not fit to be a landlord, given housing code violations, police calls, shootings, and other issues surrounding a Beaver Avenue Southeast property. Residents are circulating a petition they hope will prompt Cedar Rapids officials to revoke his landlord license permanently, following a report this month in the Gazette that the City Housing Board of Appeals had taken the unusual step of suspending for 6 months Davison's permission to rent out 2307 Beaver Avenue Southeast and three other properties listed under Property Holders LTD. Advocates are urging Cedar Rapids officials to bar Davison, age 58, from leasing his properties again once the suspension ends in April. Davison is appealing in court the board's decision. He has had enough chances to do the right thing, reads the petition, which is circulating on change.org. Enough is enough. More than 1,250 people so far have signed on to the petition. Residents Saturday went door to door to hand out flyers and spread the word about their petition after a racist epithet was spray painted on the vacant rental house March 23, just days after the Gazette report. Police are investigating the incident as a hate crime. Sophia Joseph, an advocate on the board of WeRCR, who helped circulate the petition, said residents do not need landlords dragging down the community. I think that everybody deserves to have safe housing, Joseph said. I think that everybody deserves to live somewhere free of harassment. I believe that everybody deserves to be treated with respect. Eric Gutschmidt, owner of Gutschmidt's properties in Cedar Rapids, said the petition he has helped circulate is encouraging city officials to exercise forms of oversight available to them. Peter Riley, Davison's Cedar Rapids attorney, said that landlords generally cannot control what a tenant does on rented property because landlords give up the right of possession. When there are police complaints, he said, the landlord can then be required to take steps to evict a tenant. And in this case, with the Beaver Avenue Southeast house, Riley has told the Gazette the tenant who was the source of the most trouble no longer lives there. At another property, Riley has said property holders tried to evict a tenant tied to some incidents, but was denied by the courts. He certainly has the right to conduct a legal business, subject to the laws and rules that the City of Cedar Rapids imposes, Riley said of Davison. City officials declined to comment because the case is being appealed, and they are awaiting a court ruling before any further action can be taken. Cedar Rapids Code outlines the process by which rental unit registrations and landlord business permits are suspended, revoked, or denied for a landlord. The first course of action, in order of precedence, would be for rental unit registrations to be suspended, revoked, denied, or not renewed. In this case, Davison's registrations have been suspended for 180 days. The second course of action would be a landlord's business permit to be suspended, revoked, denied, or not renewed. A city code official may revoke, suspend, deny, or deny renewal of the registrations or permit under a range of circumstances, including but not limited to the applicant, registrant, or permit holder provides false statements in an application, information, or report required under code, or failure to pay any required application, penalty, reinspection, or reinstatement fee, or noncompliance with a mitigation or remediation plan approved by the code official, or failure to comply with provisions of the Fair Housing Act, or declaration of nuisance property status. City code also states that if a rental property is declared a nuisance property, the owner or property manager must undergo rental business training before the next registration of the nuisance property. This training is a course designed to promote compliance with city code governing rentals and encourage landlords to follow best rental practices, and the description and goals are approved by the City Council. Once the four rental properties pass an inspection after the suspension ends, Riley said Davison will look to rent them again, and he said Davison has a waiting list of potential tenants. About the petitioners, Riley asked, "What do they expect him to do? I don't get it. We can't babysit our tenants." But Gutschmidt, a landlord himself, feels differently. Landlords influence their tenants' behavior. They can't control it or micromanage it, but they definitely influence it. Teray Morrow, founder of the We Are CR, said he hopes others are willing to be part of making change and influencing officials to act. "The way we feel is that a tenant is only going to be as good as their landlord," Morrow said. Joseph said the advocates are looking to rally the community to put an end to the problems. "We expect to be able to present information to them and for them to lean on this landlord as much as they can to do things that are within their ability," Joseph said, of her expectations for city council's or city officials' response to the petition. "It doesn't seem like nobody can do it alone." And the article is accompanied by a photo of the 2307 Beaver Avenue Southeast property that's in question. Also on the front page, Iowa tax deadline extended. This is a Gazette Des Moines Bureau article. Iowans who have not yet filed their 2020 individual state income taxes now will have more time. The Iowa Department of Revenue announced Monday it has extended the filing and payment deadline to June 1 for 2020 individual returns and first quarter estimated income tax payments for individuals. In issuing the order, Director of Revenue Craig Paulson said the state's economy is showing good strength and the filing extension is an appropriate step to help Iowans whose lives have been disrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic. The state's extension comes after the U.S. Treasury also lengthened the time for individuals to file their federal taxes, although those are due May 17, sooner than Iowa's new deadline. Specifically, Monday's order allows Iowa residents or non-residents required to file Iowa returns an extension for filing the IA 1040 individual income tax return and supporting forms and schedules and any associated tax payments, including quarterly estimated income tax payments that would usually be due April 30. The state's later deadline does not include business filers or other tax types of individuals. Iowa is among the states that automatically conform to IRS code, so certain unemployment compensation will not be included in Iowa income. Claims for jobless benefits have spiked as businesses shuttered or reduced staffing after the pandemic's onset. Based on federal legislation, the first $10,200 of unemployment compensation income is excluded from taxation for qualifying individuals. Some Iowans who already have filed their income taxes were not able to take advantage of that change, so the State Department of Revenue will make those adjustments. People affected by the change will not be required to file an amended return. However, the adjustments may take up to 90 days. Taxpayers who have not yet filed but who are affected should report their unemployment compensation exclusion amount on Form 1040, Line 14, using a code of M. That's the letter M. For more information, see the Revenue Department's website at tax.iowa.gov. The state said Monday it is processing refunds in 28 days, faster than its goal of 30 days. You can check on the status of your refund on the department's website. Also on the front page today, 10-digit dialing could help those in crisis. 988 is pretty easy to remember. This story is by Kat Russell. Though dialing a full 10-digit phone number may seem like an inconvenience, crisis intervention providers in the corridor say that small sacrifice could make a huge difference in the life of someone in crisis. Starting in October, Iowa residents in the 319 and 515 area codes will have to dial all 10 digits of a phone number when making calls to make way for a new 3-digit number for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. The Federal Communications Commission will require dialing both the area code and phone number starting October 24. After that, calls made without the area code may not go through, instead leading callers to a recording reminding them to dial the area code. Callers can begin using the new system April 24. In all, the change will affect 82 area codes in 32 states. Many major phone providers are sending notices to alert customers to the change. Before the permissive 10-digit dialing period begins on April 24, we will be informing customers who have Verizon numbers with the 82 impacted area codes via bill messages and a news release, Verizon spokesman Chris Serico told the Gazette in an email. We will send reminders before the mandatory 10-digit dialing deadline, October 24. The reason for the change is the rollout of the 3-digit number, 988, which can be called from anywhere in the country and will connect callers to the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. The affected Iowa area codes, which include Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, Waterloo, and Des Moines, have to make the change because some of their local phone numbers use 988 as the prefix in the 7-digit phone numbers. The new 988 hotline is set to go live July 2022. Mental health advocates such as Emily Blum, executive director of Foundation 2 in Cedar Rapids, hope people in need of crisis intervention services will remember the number because it's short and similar to 911. Individuals in the meantime can call 1-800-273-TALK to reach the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, also often called the Lifeline, which has been operating in the United States for more than 15 years, Blum said. In Iowa, Foundation 2 is the primary center that answers calls to the national hotline, fielding 75% to 80% of the approximately 14,000 calls that are routed from the national hotline to Iowa each year. Community Crisis Services and Food Bank in Iowa City is the second provider, Blum said. Its crisis line number is 319-351-0140. I think the benefit of transitioning to 988 is twofold, Blum said Monday. One part is that it's an easier number to remember. If you're having a mental health crisis or you're feeling suicidal, you might not remember the 10-digit 800 number because when you're in a major distress, you're not necessarily thinking clearly. But 988 is pretty easy to remember. The other aspect, Blum said, has to do with addressing issues around mental health. I think the other purpose of this transition is to decrease stigma, in that we all know to call 988 for a physical health emergency. And once this hotline is rolled out, you can call 988 for help with emotional distress or a mental health emergency, she said. Another benefit would be the diverting of calls from the 911 emergency line and from law enforcement. The change also highlights the current mental health crisis in the United States. Foundation 2 Crisis Services Director Drew Martell said, "In our mind, 3-digit numbers are important, right? We have 911 and 211 as examples, and now we're giving this crisis line a 3-digit number, and that's a big deal because nobody gets a 3-digit number unless they are important," he said. The suicide rate has climbed nearly 30% since 1999, with rates increasing in 49 out of 50 states over the last decade, according to statistics from Vibrant Emotional Health, formerly the Mental Health Association of New York City, the organization that administers the Lifeline. Blum said the reactions she has seen to the new 10-digit dialing requirement have been mixed. Some are saying it's a good cause, others seem to feel it will be a major inconvenience, and others still say they have been dialing 10-digit numbers for years, she said. The new requirement also could cause some hassle for Iowa businesses. Brett Moyer, general manager of Carl Chevrolet in Ankeny, told the Des Moines Register that the Carl dealerships maintain a database that includes customer phone numbers, an individual tool for any sales organization. When asked if some of those thousands of numbers might need to be updated to the required 10-digit format, he said, "Oh, geez, I assume so." John Steppy of the Gazette and the Associated Press contributed to this report. Moving on now to the Iowa Today page, a body of a second ISU student found after boat capsized. Five members of the campus club were rowing when the incident happened on Little Wall Lake. Emergency workers recovered the body of an Iowa State University student Monday, a day after a school crew club boat capsized during practice on a lake, killing one other student. The students were practicing Sunday morning at Little Wall Lake, about 15 miles north of Ames, when the scull capsized, the university said. Three members were rescued by people who live around the lake, officials said, and a dive team recovered the body of one student later in the day. The search for the missing student was called off Sunday night, but resumed around 7 a.m. Monday. Hamilton County Sheriff Doug Timmons said sonar technology was used to help pinpoint the likely location of the body, and it was recovered at about 9:45 a.m. The three students who were rescued were treated at an Ames hospital. The names had not been released Monday. The students were part of the Iowa State Crew Club, a recognized student organization. Members typically practice on Sunday afternoons, according to the club's website, but also hold early morning practices during the week. Timmons said winds at the time of the incident were around 20 to 25 miles an hour, which made conditions on the lake pretty rough. With air temperatures around 37 degrees Fahrenheit, the water would have been cold enough for hypothermia to set in within minutes. Windy conditions were of concern as authorities resumed the search for the second student found Monday, Timmons said. Gusts were expected to exceed 40 miles an hour. "We knew it was going to pick up," Timmons said. "We weren't going to put any rescuers' lives in jeopardy." ISU President Wendy Winterstein said in a written release that the accident left the Iowa State community heartbroken. "At this time, we are focused on providing support to club members, their family, and friends," Winterstein said. "We ask that everyone keep them in their thoughts during this very difficult time." Also on the Today page, an Iowa poll finds 54% favor legalizing pot, 78% back medical marijuana expansion. This is a Des Moines Register story submitted by Tony Lays. More than half of Iowans support legalizing marijuana for recreational uses, and more than three-quarters support expanding the drug's use for medical purposes, a new Des Moines Register Mediacom Iowa poll shows. Iowa lawmakers have not moved to join 14 other states and Washington, D.C. in legalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana for recreational use. But Iowans' support of the idea has significantly grown over the past 8 years, the Iowa poll shows. In the new Iowa poll, 54% of adults say they favor legalizing marijuana for recreational use, 39% oppose it, and 6% are unsure. That's about the same level of support shown in a March 2020 Iowa poll, which for the first time found a majority of Iowans, 53%, favored legalizing recreational marijuana. The new poll also shows that support for expanding Iowa's medical marijuana program remains strong, with 78% of adults saying the program should cover more diseases and conditions. Just 14% oppose such a move, and 7% are unsure. The poll of 775 Iowa adults was conducted by Selzer & Company on March 7 through 10. It has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Iowa has a small medical marijuana program, which allows sales of non-smokable products to people with certain physical ailments, such as chronic pain, seizures, and cancer. The program, which launched in 2018, sells strictly regulated creams, oils, capsules, and vaporizers from up to 5 dispensaries across the state. Only about 5,100 patients have cards allowing them to use the program, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Iowa currently has licensed medical marijuana dispensaries in Sioux City, Waterloo, and the Des Moines suburb of Windsor Heights. State administrators have approved the addition of dispensaries to Iowa City and Council Bluffs. They are to replace Davenport and Council Bluffs dispensaries, which closed in 2020. Republicans take a dimmer view of marijuana legalization than Democrats do, the new Iowa poll shows. Among Republicans, just 31% favor legalizing it for recreational use, compared with 71% of Democrats and 59% of political independents. Regarding expansion of Iowa's medical marijuana program, 61% of Republicans favor the move, compared with 88% of Democrats and 84% of political independents, according to the poll. Moving now to the Insight page, I've chosen to read Iowa City's Free Clinic Turns 50, this guest column by Barbara Vinograde. This year, the Iowa City Free Medical and Dental Clinic is celebrating a very significant anniversary. 50 years ago, on March 19, 1971, the first free clinic was held in Iowa City. Since then, thousands and thousands of uninsured people in our community have had a place to go for medical and dental needed care. The Iowa City Free Clinic is the second largest running free clinic in the United States. We are here today because of incredible community support, support that has allowed us to grow and to thrive. We work with hundreds of volunteers from a wide range of disciplines and have many strong partnerships with local organizations and businesses. We now serve as a medical home for most of our patients, 60% of whom are diagnosed with at least one chronic disease. We hold 6 medical and 3 dental clinics a week, as well as providing specialty services. The clinic has been through many changes in its 50 years. In its first year, it had to move 3 times until it landed in the basement of the Wesley Foundation. Thanks to the generosity and compassion of Dave Schult, who was the foundation's director, the space was rent-free for the first 5 years. Wesley served as the clinic's home until 2006, at which time it was moved to the current location at 2440 Towncrest Drive. Like all medical practices, this past year was challenging for our patients, staff, and volunteers. Our service delivery had to change, but we stayed open. Today, while we are not yet back to our pre-pandemic level of service, we have systems in place to safely provide care for many people. While the clinic's primary mission is healthcare, it also serves as an educational site for medical, dental, nursing, and public health students. These future providers get the opportunity to work in an uninsured, free clinic environment and to learn about the barriers to healthcare access. In a 1986 interview with the Press Citizen, Dave Schult said, "At the free clinic, everyone learns a lot." Dave was a wise man, and his words are so true. "I know how much I've learned in my many years at the clinic. I've learned how much a community can do when they work together. I've learned how much it means to provide someone with a month of insulin, a needed mammogram, or a dental appointment. And I've learned that free clinic services are very much needed." If you would like to learn more about the clinic, please visit our Facebook page, where we are posting stories from our past and highlighting community partnerships. We are also working on an oral history project, which will be on our website, through which past volunteers, staff, and supporters will share their clinic experiences. And if all goes well, we will have an open house in the fall. The founders of the clinic believed access to health care was a basic human right. This belief remains at the heart of the clinic's continued work. Barbara Vinograde is the executive director of the Iowa City Free Medical and Dental Clinic and submitted the guest editorial. At Liberty by Adam Sullivan today is titled "Pot Popular, Except with Lawmakers." It's one of the only issues where a supermajority of Iowans agree, but Iowa lawmakers are set to go another year without taking any significant action. A whopping 78% of Iowans support expanding the medical cannabis program to include more conditions, while just 14% oppose it, according to a Des Moines Register poll released last week. It's hard to find another policy proposal with such widespread support in Iowa. Politicians can only dream of being so popular. Governor Kim Reynolds has 46% approval, and President Joe Biden 47%, according to the latest Iowa poll. Several of the bills Republicans are advancing this year are underwater in terms of public support, reducing the early voting period, 42%, amending the state constitution to say it does not recognize abortion rights, 31%, and cutting unemployment benefits for laid-off workers, 17%. Only two policy proposals come close to medical marijuana's popularity in the Register's latest round of polling. Increased penalties for people who assault law enforcement officers get 75% approval, and a ban on racial profiling of police gets 70%. The governor proposed both at the start of the legislative session, but Republican lawmakers are only interested in the former. Surprisingly, medical cannabis is more popular with Iowans than Donald Trump is with Iowa Republicans. If Trump seeks the GOP nomination in 2024, 61% of Iowa Republican caucus-goers would support him, according to a poll this month by Victory Insights. So, how are lawmakers acting on the public's demand for a better marijuana program? They're not. Iowa has one of the weakest systems in the country, allowing a smaller number of people to get limited products at a few dispensaries. Only about 5,000 Iowans have active medical cards as of last month. The law provides for 5 dispensaries and 2 manufacturers statewide, but we are not even operating at that meager capacity, as businesses find they can't stay afloat under the weight of Iowa's extreme regulations. The state now is in the process of licensing 2 more dispensaries and a 2nd manufacturer. Hopefully, they'll stick around. Republicans controlling the Iowa legislature are not poised to take significant action on medical cannabis this year. Lawmakers considered a bill to improve the program, reduce fees for both patients and businesses, lift the limit of 5 dispensaries, and authorize mobile dispensaries. While it would not expand the set of medical conditions covered, it could bolster access by allowing up to 1 marijuana dispensary per county. It still would not be a robust program, but it would be an improvement. That bill has faltered since earning approval from a bipartisan panel in February. Aside from the medical program, legislation to decrease penalties for marijuana possession faces long odds, and more aggressive marijuana decriminalization bills have been introduced but not taken up. Under Iowa's medical cannabis system, a patient in Keokuk has to make a nearly 3-hour drive to Waterloo to get medicine. But it's only about an hour to Quincy, Illinois, where they could buy a much wider variety of recreational products to illegally traffic back to home. Again, that is Adam Sullivan's column. And a few letters to the editor today. Reader sees bias on Gazette editorial pages. There are probably just as many conservatives in our city as Democrats, yet every editorial letter and cartoon seems to be biased against the conservatives. Maybe it's time someone else was in charge of the editorial page. Signed by Roscoe Schwartz in Cedar Rapids. And our second letter, vote against anti-violence bill is a vote against women. I am a 67-year-old Iowa woman. I've seen a lot of change in our state over the years, but now I feel afraid. As a woman who lived in Iowa during the women's rights movement of the 70s, I just cannot believe that my representative in the 1st Congressional District, Ashley Hinson, would vote against the Violence Against Women Act. In 1919, the Iowa legislature voted to ratify the 19th Amendment, which ensured women the right to vote. It is now 2021, and Ashley votes against women? What is going on? Women make up 49.6% of Iowa's population, so why are we not protecting those women who need our help? I went to the 1st District office for answers and got none. If you want answers too, call Hinson's office. I am thankful for those who did vote with their heart for the reauthorization of the 1994 law protecting and providing resources for victims of domestic and sexual violence. If Hinson is not fighting for women, who is she fighting for? And that letter is signed by Debbie Koopman in Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, March 30 on IRIS. And now we turn to today's obituary page. in the short notices. From Al Burnett, Diane Lynn Arnold, age 69, died Sunday, March 28. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. In Cedar Rapids, Herbert Frederick Beer, age 96, died Saturday, March 27. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. From Clarence, Laverne King, Jr., age 74, died Sunday, March 28. Chapman Funeral Home, Clarence. In Maquoketa, Asina Ernest, age 52, died Saturday, March 27. Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. From Marengo, Mary Jane Dimmer, age 67, died Friday, March 26. The Kloster Funeral Home in Marengo is in charge. And from Williamsburg, Tate B. Schaefer, age 13, died Monday, March 29. Powell Funeral Home, Williamsburg. Moving now to the longer notices. From Clarence, Vivian Ruth Giebelstein. Services are at 10 a.m. Wednesday, March 31st, and this is a service location change. So services for Vivian are at St. John's United Church of Christ in Clarence. In Iowa City, Dick Rimbolt passed away peacefully at the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Iowa City on March 26th, 6 days after his 73rd birthday. Dick battled with Alzheimer's for several years and had been living in the memory care unit at Keystone prior to his transfer to the Birdhouse. Services celebrating Dick's life will be held at a later date to be announced. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in Dick's memory to the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Johnson County or Pathways of Iowa City. Gay and Chia Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Cedar Rapids, Lois Darlene Fisher, age 97, passed away on Friday, March 26, at the Gardens in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, April 1st, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A private service will take place at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Burial to follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website under the obituary for Lois Darlene Fisher, starting at 2 p.m. Friday, April 2nd. From Cedar Rapids, Richard James Swaka, age Cedar Rapids, who recently turned 89, passed away March 27. Visitation will be from 4 to 8, Wednesday, March 31st, at Cedar Memorial Funeral Home. A private family service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories with burial following at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. A live stream of this service can be viewed at 11 a.m. Thursday, April 1st. The service can be viewed on the Cedar Memorial website under the obituary for Richard Swaka. From Clarence, Devin Utesler, age 27, of Cassville, Wisconsin, formerly of Clarence, passed away Saturday, March 27, at Grant Regional Hospital in Lancaster, Wisconsin. Funeral service will be held at 10:30 Thursday, April 1, at St. John's United Church of Christ, with the Reverend Matt Schneider Adams officiating. Burial will follow at St. John's Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 Wednesday, March 31st, at Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence. From Independence, Michael J. Hayward, age 69, died Saturday, March 27, at the Buchanan County Health Center in Independence after battling a lengthy illness. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March 31st, at St. John Catholic Church, Independence, with Father David Beckman, celebrant. Burial will follow at the church cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 Tuesday, March 30th, at White Funeral Home, Independence, where there will be a parish rosary at 4 p.m. and a parish vigil service at 7. Visitation will continue at the funeral home for an hour before services on Wednesday. Memorials will be directed to the Independence Athletic Booster Club. From Iowa City, Patricia Ann Payton, age 84, died March 26th at her home. At Patricia's request, no funeral service will be held. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed toward the Regina Foundation or to a charity of your choice. In Manchester, Corrine C. Sauer, age 88, of Manchester, passed away Monday, March 29, at Luther Manor Care in Dubuque. Graveside service for Corrine will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, April 2nd at the Coggin Cemetery in Coggin. Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home Cremation Service is assisting the family. From Iowa City, Terrence, known as Terry Spurgeon, age 52, died Sunday, March 28, at home. Graveside services will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, March 31st at St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established in Terry's name. From Monticello, Jennifer Claren, age 53, died Sunday, March 28, at her home following an extended illness. Graveside services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, March 31st at Oakwood Cemetery. The Reverend Edward Moriano will officiate at the services. Getch Funeral Home Monticello has taken Jenny and her family into their care. You can visit www.getchonline.com to sign the guest book or share your thoughts. In Williamsburg, Helen Lucille Marine died March 28, just as Red Wing Blackbirds had returned to Iowa. She was born November 21, 1922, in rural Washington County. And here's an interesting sidelight. Helen eloped with Marion Marine. They told their parents that they were going to visit cousins, but got married instead in Cahokia, Missouri, February 14, 1943. When they returned, they went back to their parents' homes as if nothing had happened. But the cat was out of the bag when the marriage license arrived a week later and Marion's mother opened the mail. There will be a graveside service at the Wellman Cemetery for immediate family. Memorials may be directed to the Wellman Schofield Library or Mid Prairie Community School District Foundation. From Monticello, David C., known as Murfeld, age 64, passed away Sunday, March 28, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Visitation will be held from 4 to 8 Tuesday, March 30, at Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello. Visitation will continue from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Wednesday at the funeral home. Prior to the service, a mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, March 31st, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Monticello, with burial in the church cemetery. The Reverend Paul Baldwin will officiate. And lastly, from Vinton, Sheila Ray David Bain, age 79, peacefully passed away at her daughter's home, surrounded by family, on March 29. Public visitation will be from 5 to 7, Wednesday, March 31st, at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel Stateroom. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Unity Point Hospice or St. George Church. Moving now to the sports page, this high school football story, Liberty, a once-in-a-lifetime job for Harris. Ex-Washington Coast had a 21-7 record with the Demons. This story is by K.J. Pilcher for the Gazette. Magic is in the work. James Harris has applied that philosophy as the head football coach at Washington, Iowa, one he subscribes to in his daily life. You have to be willing to show up every day and consistently put in the work necessary if you want to be successful, Harris said. It doesn't just happen all of a sudden. It happens through cumulative effort and consistent buy-in. He will continue that approach as the new Iowa City Liberty football coach. School officials announced Monday that Harris will become the second head football coach in school history, replacing Jeff Gordon, who stepped down after last season. Gordon coached freshmen and sophomores before taking over the varsity program for its first season in 2018. Harris said it was a tough decision, but one he couldn't pass. It's bittersweet for me to leave Washington, which is where I graduated from, and I got to coach great young people and coach with great coaches, said Harris, who met with his Washington players Monday and expects to meet virtually with Lightning athletes midweek. It's with a heavy heart that I do this, but I do it because I believe Iowa City Liberty job is once-in-a-lifetime community opportunity. Harris coached the Demons for three seasons, posting a 21-7 overall record. He led the Demons to Class 3A playoff berths in 2019 and 2020, including an 8-1 mark last fall. Harris was selected as a coach for the 2021 Shrine Bowl and is a nationally certified strength and conditioning specialist. The expectation we have is that he's going to come in and teach our kids how to play football and teach our kids the other things that come with football that translate into lifelong lessons, Liberty Athletics Director Mike Morrison said. The fact that he's a football coach and a strength coach are just outside pieces. More importantly, he's also an amazing person and a great fit for us. We were looking for someone who could bring an impact to our building. We think he's the guy that could do that. Liberty was 2-3 last season in its first as a 4A school. The Lightning were 7-3 in 2019, earning the school's first playoff berth in 3A. The school opened in 2017 and has plenty of resources, including newer facilities. Harris is ready for the challenge. Getting to work in a new school with incredible facilities and a great young group of kids is going to be exciting, Harris said. Also on the sports page is a photo of several girls playing soccer. Iowa City Liberty's Adolphine Kanyiki, number 9, is tripped up while running alongside Cedar Rapids Xavier's Ellie Kochner, number 10, in pursuit of the ball during their Jamboree scrimmage last night at Kingston Stadium in Cedar Rapids. And also a photo of Cedar Rapids Prairie's Alexis Detterbeck, number 16, and Iowa City West's Maddie Smith, also jersey number 16, collide while they compete for the ball last night at Kingston Stadium. Moving now to the Business 380 page, Cedar Rapids Telecom buys a New Hampton company. This story by John Steppe. Cedar Rapids-based business telecommunications company Telecom Services of Iowa purchased New Hampton-based Robinson Telecommunications, the company said in a news release Monday. The acquisition expands TS Iowa's footprint in Iowa, which now will reach as far south as Fairfield and Mount Pleasant, and as far north as New Hampton. TS Iowa sells business telephone systems, surveillance systems, network infrastructure, and other telecom technology. The company did not disclose specific terms for the sale. We view this as an excellent opportunity to expand our base of telephone system customers into an area that geographically does not adversely stretch our response capabilities, said TS Iowa's president in the news release. And EntreeFest is set for a hybrid format, sessions scheduled for June 10 and 11. EntreeFest, the annual two-day entrepreneurism conference, will offer in-person and online options. When you purchase your 2021 EntreeFest ticket, you will be able to choose the format that's best for you. New Bohemian Innovation Collaborative Chief Operating Officer Jill Wilkins said in a news release about the Cedar Rapids event that's set for June 10 and 11. In-person attendees will receive a health assessment before the program to be completed before arriving at the site, the organization said in that release. State and local government and venue restrictions will be enforced, and attendees will be required to wear face coverings and maintain social distancing requirements. If the current health situation in Cedar Rapids changes and anyone is not comfortable attending in person, we will work with attendees who have purchased an in-person ticket to transfer their ticket to virtual, Wilkins said. The first slate of speakers for the hybrid sessions can be viewed at entrefest.com/about/speakers. EntreeFest will be presented by the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance and produced by Nubo Co., a 501(c) organization. Moving on to the community page, here are the Eastern Iowa briefs for today. In Iowa City, Agape Cafe to hold online anniversary fundraiser. The Agape Cafe at Old Brick in Iowa City will celebrate its 28th anniversary Wednesday by having an online fundraiser. Due to the pandemic, the annual fundraiser has moved online. Supporters can visit www.agapecafe.org to contribute via PayPal or credit debit card. Checks made out to Agape Cafe may also be mailed to 26 East Market Street, Iowa City, 52245. The Episcopal Diocese of Iowa will match the first $10,000 in donations to Agape Cafe. Organizers say financial support is more important than ever, The costs increased significantly this past year due to the challenges of the pandemic, but the cafe's mission of serving food with dignity continues. Though the fundraiser begins Wednesday, contributions can be made at any time. Since 1993, the Agape Cafe has been serving free restaurant-style breakfasts to guests on Wednesdays. Students at the University of Iowa began the cafe under the guidance of the Episcopal Chaplaincy. Since then, the cafe has become an Iowa City institution for those who may be homeless or food insecure. More information is available at the www.agapecafe.org. And in Cedar Rapids, Hy-Vee First Responders to give away 500 hams on Wednesday. As part of its annual One Step Hams for the Holidays campaign, Hy-Vee employees and local first responders will distribute 500 hams Wednesday, beginning at 5 p.m. The event, which benefits families in need, will be held at Veterans Memorial Stadium, 950 Rockford Road, Southwest. The giveaway, part of Hams for the Holidays, will run for 2 hours or until all the hams are distributed, whichever occurs first. To follow appropriate social distancing guidelines, hams will be safely loaded into vehicles using a contactless drive-through method to minimize physical contact. All event volunteers will be wearing masks and gloves for additional safety measures. And in eastern Iowa, the Iowa DNR to begin annual prescribed spring burning. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources will conduct prescribed burns this spring on wildlife management areas managed by the Iowa's DNR's Iowa River Wildlife Unit in Lynn, Johnson, Benton, Iowa, Tama, Cedar, and Mahaska counties. Areas scheduled for prescribed burns are Iowa River Corridor in Benton, Tama, and Iowa counties. Spring Grove, Union Grove, Cunch and West Salt Creek in Tama County, Hawthorne Lake in Mahaska County, Hawkeye Wildlife Area, Redbird in Johnson County, Mink Run in Cedar County, Chena Lakes in Linn County, and Dudgeon Lake in Benton County. Prescribed burns are used to improve wildlife habitat, control invasive plant species, restore and maintain native plant communities, and reduce wildfire potential. Areas are typically burned every 1 to 5 years. Prescribed burns typically begin mid to late morning and are completed by late afternoon or early evening between late March and late May. Contact DNR wildlife biologist Steve Woodruff at 319-330-7013 with any questions or concerns regarding burns in these counties. And lastly, in Maquoketa, register to see how prescribed fires work at Friday night burn. Have you ever wondered why conservation agencies burn their prairies in the spring? Spring is the time of year when conservation managers conduct prescribed burns on prairies and grasslands to promote native plant growth and to combat unwanted species. At 7 p.m. Friday, Jackson County conservation staff at Prairie Creek Recreation Area will teach participants about prescribed fire with the added excitement of watching the burn at night. Meet at the Prairie Creek Pavilion, 1215 East Summit Street, Maquoketa. Registration is required. Please register 48 hours in advance. To register or for more information, call Jackson County Conservation at 563-652-3783 or email tony@jacksoncb.com. Also on the community page is an article, Easter Experience. At a glance, it is Trail to Tomb, Drive-By Easter Experience, outside St. Mark's Lutheran Church, 8300 C Avenue in Marion. Enter the parking lot from East Robbins Road. Stay in your vehicle the entire time. Bring a mobile device to access the audio. It runs from 5 to 7 Thursday and Friday and is family friendly. It features 8 narration tracks with music for 8 scenes spanning Palm Sunday to Christ's empty tomb. More than 75 volunteers each night and 500 Easter eggs or gifts for the children will be provided. The cost is free, but donations are accepted for the Wellington Heights Community Church. And for more details, visit stmarkscr.org/trail-to-tomb. The article is accompanied by a photo and is submitted by Diana Nolan. When 4,000 people arrive in 1,000 cars to see your live nativity, it's a sign. A sign that, especially during COVID, people are looking for alternative ways to celebrate the most important seasons in the life of the church. It had an overwhelming success, more than we ever thought, the Reverend Paul Henning said. He's the senior pastor at St. Mark's Lutheran in Marion, which staged The Living Story, a drive-by nativity over three nights in December. After the first night, we had to ask police officers to be there to help with the flow of traffic. Building on that response, St. Mark's is presenting Trail to the Tomb from 5 to 7 Thursday and Friday in the church parking lot. Motorists will enter from East Robbins Road and drive by eight scenes depicting the final week of Jesus' life, beginning with Palm Sunday and ending with the empty tomb. As with the Christmas story, where a camel was especially popular, the Easter event will feature live animals too, including a donkey, and children will receive an Easter gift at the end of the drive. We learned so much, Henning said, of the Christmas event, and those lessons are carrying over to the Easter experience. We learned where to set things up in the parking lot. We learned all the technical issues and how many people will come without cell phone technology. We said, if we're going to do this, we better get started, and everybody was excited. They're welcoming this week's milder temperatures, too. The event is designed to appeal to people of other faiths or no faith base or church home, as well as those who celebrate the Easter season. And it's all free. Our overall reason for doing this is we just want to bless our community with something safe and family-friendly, Henning said. Everybody feels like we're moving out of the pandemic, and that's certainly our hope. But I know even at our church, there will be a lot of people who don't come and attend in-person Easter service. And so we wanted to give our community another way to remember this Passion Week. And while they weren't expecting any donations at the Christmas event, some people wanted to give. If that's the case at this upcoming presentation, Henning said any donations collected will be given to the Wellington Heights Community Church. Pastors Kian and Stephanie Carter launched the Multicultural Church a month before the pandemic hit last year, and after meeting virtually, they're now looking for a home base. We've partnered with them in mutual ministry and support, Henning said, especially during cleanup and recovery following the derecho. I think the world of Kian Carter, and we just look at our partnership as a way to advance the gospel beyond racial and social barriers. And that does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS for today. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a great, safe day.
This is Jim Ralston with an Irish short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers from Dubuque. Don Dwebar, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. "I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers," he told me. "I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library." While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers strategy. Just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play. From famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checker strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Dwebar, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. "Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training," Don said. He unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. "It's like the Mona Lisa," Mr. Checker said, of his museum. "You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dwebar." If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.